I'm opening this meeting of the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology on March 9th. I apologize for my late arrival. Would you please introduce the topics for today's informational meeting?
Absolutely. Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, today we have three items up. The first is an information security update from the State Chief Information Officer and the State Chief Information Security Officer. We thought it'd be timely for them to come back and give us an update on the state's progress in implementing Executive Order 1613. We'll then move to an information technology overview from one of our larger state agencies, the Oregon Department of Transportation. They've got an overview and two specific projects that they're going to be giving us an update on. And then lastly, we'll hear from the Office of the State CIO, Mr. Benetton, who is the Strategic Technology Officer for the Healthy People Program Area, will be giving an update on the Information Resource Management Plan for that that program area. So with that, Alex and Stefan, if you could come on up, and if you could introduce yourself for the record before you begin presenting.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the State of Oregon.
Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. My name is Stefan Richards. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the State of Oregon. I work in the State CIO's office. I believe what we were asked to bring forward was a presentation on the execution of the Executive Order 1613, the Governor's Executive Order to unify cybersecurity in the state. I want to give a little bit of context, since I know there's some new committee members I haven't seen in this committee before. But I promise it's really short, and then talk about what I like pretty excited about, which is to brag about our progress, because I think we've gotten a lot done in just 6 months. So this is the quick history lesson here. So I joined the state in 2014, a little bit off of that page. One of the first experiences I had was one of the largest breaches in Oregon's Oregon state government's history, of about 900,000 records being breached. And what I saw there was a lot of you know, there's technologies in place, and a lot of people doing good work, but there was a lot of things that had fallen into neglect, a lot of things that over time people forgot about. You know, we got to keep discipline on those. And I think that's pretty relevant to what we're seeing now in our executive order execution, and I'll come back to that. But in 2015, I landed at the data center, and at that point was a pretty big pivotal moment, because the office that I had joined, which was originally mostly policy with a very few technical folks to do analysis, just five people, we now had operational security ownership of the data center, and the CIO reorganized the data center and gave us significantly more resources. So we are now a team of 25 with operational responsibility for the security of the data center. So that was a pretty big pivotal moment for us. Along the way here, we started working with the National Governors Association on some big ideas we have, which is part of the Senate Bill 90, which is coming up, I think will be coming to this committee soon. But then in September, about 2 years from my start at the data start as a state chief information security officer, at that point we'd had two breaches like the first one I'd run into, where we got to close to a million records breached, and we had had dozens of small ones, about six or seven moderate ones. And one of the things, one of the conclusions was, across that whole landscape, a lot of them looked the same as the first one, where we saw people doing good work, but also neglect in places that what I would call sort of foundational areas, you know, patching and things that are just good hygiene. What we also saw was almost every one of the incidents would end in a really uncomfortable place, where because logging and instrumentation was not properly in place, we couldn't tell as an investigator exactly what had happened. And so we're left with having to say, well, this is the worst that could have happened. That's what we have to assume, because we couldn't prove otherwise. And so that was pretty significant. We shared those thoughts with the governor's office, and that's where we ended up with the executive order, 1613, to bring together security in the state of Oregon for the executive branch, and to execute on getting those monitoring instrumentation things in place, understanding the risks we really are carrying around, and start working on a plan to get it better as a unified group. So the executive order effectively had three main pieces. We've kind of broke it into four here on this visual.
Excuse me.
Yes, ma'am.
Could you remind me again the date of the executive order? Or approximately.
September of 2016.
Thank you.
Yeah, September of last year, so about 6 months ago. I've broken this into four areas, but really there were three main areas that the governor directed us to take care of. One was to do an agency-by-agency risk assessment across the entire executive branch. The second was to conduct training and awareness across all the members of the executive branch. And the last was to come up with this plan. Based on the risks we found, what would be the plan for the state moving forward? And that's what these three pillars represent. As we've distilled that, we've taken that opportunity to baseline the state to NIST standards, which are federally recognized standards. It's a little bit of a shift from our previous ISO-based model. But that gave us a common framework to measure every agency the same way and to see just where the maturity was in a common way, which I don't think we've really had before. This pillar that we've added here, this fourth one, that you don't sort of say, well, what's this vulnerability management pillar? That pillar really is part of the risk assessment pillar in my mind, but we had scanning infrastructure for the enterprise in place. We'd paid for it back in 2014 when I had just started, but very few agencies were using it. And it was one of the things that we knew we could get a lot of information about the risk of the state by increasing the footprint of that scanning. And that would really give us something, a very concrete, measurable statistic of how well the systems in the state are being secured. And I've got some great progress on that. So it's really kind of part of our vulnerability or part of our risk management process. So let's talk about the risk management, the risk assessments themselves. What we did is we came up with a modular approach. You can see here there's six modules. Those modules are then applied based on the agency's what they do in that agency. And so what you see listed down on the right-hand side is 20 agencies sort of anonymized and which modules were assigned to each of those agencies. So, for example, if there's no level 4 data, which is the sort of life and limb critical data, an example might be criminal justice information or like AIDS information, things like this. If they have that data in their agency based on the agency's own reporting, then we have a module to check the security around that because there's very specific in policy and guidelines rules around how to protect that data, just as an example. A lot of people don't have it, so you see about half those agencies don't even have that module. But we did scanning. We did a profile, that cybersecurity profile is really aligning to the NIST framework that I mentioned. We're looking at the IT infrastructure, so asking questions of technical folks and actually going and looking at network diagrams and how have you designed your security. External application scanning, so this is us walking the perimeter, so we have no credentials. It's just like an outside in, like an attacker would see each of these agencies. If they're building applications, we do application assessment of their application development and management process. And then I mentioned the level 4 data already. I mentioned that I put scanning as part of the risk assessment. In the internal scanning, this is something we could do right out of the gate. We already had the scanning infrastructure. We already had the expertise. So what we did is we quickly tried to increase the real estate. So this is the first place I get to brag about some results. We've estimated we got about 70,000 endpoints that are scannable on state networks in the executive branch. When we started this, we were scanning about 34,000 hosts that were getting scanned on semi-periodic basis. Different agencies had different periodicities. And that was across about 24 agencies. So we had at some point had many more agencies do this, but only about 24 were actually continuing to use the tool. Where we are today, this was actually written, when this was written about a week ago, we had 50,000 hosts. I got a text on the way over here, we're actually 51,500 hosts. So we are getting close to doubling our number of hosts that we now have scanned. We've increased to 34 agencies, so we increased about 50% in the number of agencies we've touched. And then you see there that bottom bullet, we're talking about 10 agencies in phase two. What we did is we took advantage of the people that had at any time installed this product and already had it and tried to get them up to current. So we said, hey, let's get it so it's working on every quarter we're hitting the button. This phase two is actually new deployments, people that have never had, agencies have never had scanning infrastructure at all. And we have a fast track to do those next 10 within this biennium. The green line at the side there is literally the number of hosts we're touching. And the red is the area under the graph is the vulnerabilities. So that's how many things we're finding. So you can see it kind of goes up. As we get more hosts, we find more vulnerabilities. The vulnerability, as we brought more agencies in, what we found in trending in vulnerabilities, which is a pretty critical finding to really sort of verify that we really have some of that hygiene work to do that I mentioned, as I saw in some of the breaches. Our best case was about, so I had to define this term, a criticals per host. So a vulnerability is classified critical if it's highly exploitable, it's discoverable, and it would have severe impact if it were exploited. So in other words, you've got kind of the magic three things you'd need to say this is the worst kind of thing you could find in your environment. The best case we have is about point on an average across all the hosts in their environment, 0.37 for one agency. Worst case I have is close to 9, 8.89 criticals per host. So that means on average, each device sitting on the network has as many as, in that particular agency, as many as 9 critical vulnerabilities. So that's a huge number. You know, the mean is about 3.5. So you can see, even if we just look across everything and we average the good ones and the bad ones, it's a pretty significant number that we're well over 3 critical vulnerabilities per object in the environment. So the good news is that now we have a metric, an early metric to start driving down. Yes.
I'm going to ask question now. I was just asking for advice from the committee administrator. I thought I had missed something.
Okay.
I need to ask you the question.
Yes.
When we talk about criticals per host and how many devices, I start wondering, I need to then be reminded, what are devices? What's included in this scan? Because there are so many things that if you connect to this, it gets you access to that, you know, like this either connects me to something, or I have learned in the last month or two, someone can turn it into a microphone and listen all the time to what's going on around me. So, and if something is connected physically through a cable or through a wireless connection, what are you scanning? How many things?
Thank you for the question, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. These scans, these endpoints, the definition of those endpoints would be things that are on the network often or permanently connected to the network. So we're talking about PCs, laptops, tablets, if they are used day-to-day and permanently attached to the network. And for the most part, we don't do that. We generally keep them outside of the network. It includes network equipment, so like firewalls and switches and things that make the network work. It doesn't include cell phones and other, like I said, tablets and things that people bring in. Typically, they're on the guest networks, so they're not actually part of the corporate network. So it's devices that are on the corporate network. Printers would be included there. If they respond to a ping generally on the network, we can do it, which is ping is just a way that we send a packet out and they send something back. Hopefully that answers.
Yes. Thank you.
Moving on from scanning, I want to talk a little bit about how we actually have engaged on the risk assessment. So the rest of it, so the other 5 modules, what we did is we engaged, we went out, we did a request for a proposal. We've got 9 vendors under contract, and we're running them all in parallel, looking at each agency one by one and going through those modules as they apply. We've completed 2, so I've been to one of the 2 exit interviews, and so far the exit interviews have looked like a lot of the things that are represented at the beginning. There's good stuff happening, but there's hygiene things that are easy to forget that kind of fall into disrepair as time goes on, like you kind of forget to patch or you forget to update an application. We've had some incidental reports of quite sensational information, but I don't have those final reports yet, so I'm not really ready to share sensational things yet. I've basically seen what I expected to see from the vulnerabilities I've seen. There's definitely work to be done. We have 7 still in progress now. We've got 5 just about to start, where we've negotiated the statements of work. We're getting ready to actually start the work. The way these engagements look, they come, they do, they survey, they talk to the individuals, and they kind of dig through. They check against the NIST framework to see what controls are in place. They scan. If the scanning's not happening, they'll come and bring their own scanning and scan internally. We're actually running all the external scanning, so the vendors aren't doing the external scanning. That's being done by one vendor across the whole state. And so they come and they do all of that, then they come and do an exit conference, and then we get a final report. And those final reports I'm still waiting on for those two that have finished. I mentioned external scanning. As I said, we went to one vendor, and that was basically because it's the easiest way for us to get consistent results was to have one vendor do this. To be clear, this is not penetration testing where they're trying to attack, but it's literally just taking tools that anybody could get a hold of and scanning the perimeter and saying, what do I find? Do I find any unlocked doors effectively? And if they do, then they kind of go through the door and see what they find, but they don't go deep. They just probe. They just kind of look at what did they find. We found four pretty significant exposures is what I'll call them, meaning here's a directory with a bunch of files in it. We don't know if anybody went to it, but it was sitting there completely unprotected. So we fixed those four. Just from this so far of where we're at, we've had four, at least if they've come to my desk. We finished eight agencies, and we have the next seven in the works now. We have 11 scheduled for the next quarter, which brings us to a total of there'll be 26 agencies. So it's those top 20 that are getting those risk assessments, and then we had six more that didn't quite make the top 20 bar, but the risk of their applications, we determined that we should get them scanned as well. So we're going to have 26 by the end of this biennium, and we're about close to about a third of the way through those. So that's the risk assessment part. The second deliverable that was clearly laid out in the executive order was awareness and training. What we've done with awareness and training is really, it says awareness and training. I really see that as awareness being one thing and training being a second thing. The awareness being simply just getting a place in people's heads that they're thinking about security on a regular basis. And what we picked for that is we have licensed videos, short videos, about 2 minutes, well-produced security videos that deal with a single topic. A lot of them are things that are both at work and at home, like phishing or something that apply equally at home as at work. And they are, the intention is that, and we've been working with agency leadership, is that we bring out about one of these a month and have people take 2 minutes out of their day at once a month, and they would see one security incident, but now it's staying fresh of mind. From a training perspective, true, like, let's, you know, don't click on that email. If you see this, go what to do about it. That's kind of more in the training. We're still working on procurement. We're actually on a second round because we didn't get good response on the first one, and actually we still had kind of weak response on the second one. But we're close to having a replacement for the existing training. The training we have now is just showing signs of age. You know, security moves very fast. The training that's there now is about 5 years old. What we want to do is get a training that's going to be regularly updated as part of the license that we pay. We've also engaged.
For a minute. Yes. Is the training more about what to look for or what to do and how to fix something when you find it?
Coach, thank you for the question. Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, what we're looking for is training that I can give to everybody in the executive branch, no matter what their function, and give them an idea of when to know that they've seen something that they maybe need to call somebody about. Or if they see like an email, hey, don't click on that email, call somebody. Very simple training, but it's sort of it's past the awareness. It's literally like, hey, you know, this is what it really looks like. This is what you should do. Here's some scenarios you could get into, and then what to do about it. The ones that exist today, there's about a half dozen modules that cover very specific topics like bad emails or, things of that nature that mm-hmm. would be common to everybody in an office environment. This is not like targeted deep training or technical training for security professionals or IT professionals. This bottom training, though, is a specialized training. It's one we're going to have before the end of the biennium, which is a specialized training in deep technical controls. We're looking at having about 100 participants in that. That's scheduled for June. So that's we're just finishing up the procurement on that. So we're kind of hitting training for everyone, training for specialists, as well as awareness. I'm sorry. Okay. See where we're at. Okay, before I step away from this, I don't have a slide for it, but I didn't want to talk about the third deliverable, which is the plan. We want a lot of this risk information to inform the plan. The intention was we had a risk-informed plan, but obviously we're going to be just through the top 20 at the end of the biennium, so we can't wait that long. The governor's executive order runs to the end of this biennium. I need to deliver something this biennium. So what we have done is we framed out are what we see as the vision and mission, the high-level objectives, and even the low-level goals of what we would do. And that plan, in my mind, is the plan regardless of whether we move forward with Senate Bill 90 and unify or we stay in our current configuration. They are the priorities for the state. Which places do we need to address? As the risk information comes in, we'll reset that. But basically, it's been set based on historical breaches we've had, things we've seen in the environment, risk assessments we've had, we already had. We've started that prioritization. The next step of that is we actually sent out the invites and have had the first accepts for this, and then first meeting will be next week. We formed a steering team from across agencies to look at the list of things that I and my team have come up with as the priorities and start working on how can we transition into those and how can we get those done at a very practical level. You know, which ones do we do first? How do we do this and not completely break a business? And the participants are folks from the director level, folks from the CIO level, and folks that are in security that are going to participate in that committee. And as I said, they're really directing the priorities, not so much what's on the list, but what order we do it and what is the right path. It's going to be get us the best cooperation, the most effective implementation. And so I'm hoping that they are starting convening next week. They have a charter and 8 meetings lined out that would run to the end of the biennium, and we'll have a report or a plan, which will include this execution plan and talk about organization and transition to centralized functions, should that be the right model, all by the end of the biennium. So with that, I think there's one more slide that the boss is going
to
talk
about. So to that point, you know, so a lot of, there have been questions around how we're going to go about doing this. And one of the things that's true, as you all know, equipment, hardware, software, that can be designed for a single purpose, for a single thing that it's supposed to do. It can be customized, it can be created so that it just does one thing. It's what we call bespoke. You know, people not so much. People do lots of things. You know, we don't have people that are designed for, so a security person doesn't look just like, you know, one thing that, oh, that's a security person and I'm just gonna, like a firewall or some kind of a scanner or something like that. So people are very fungible, right? So that makes it a lot harder in some ways to identify or articulate, okay, so who's all doing security in this group? Well, everybody's doing security in this group. Well, we don't want to take everybody. So we take the ones, and that's what our approach is. We take the ones that we think are primarily doing security, primarily doing the work of a security operations person, and we leave them in the agency. And that's how we've approached this thus far. That's been our proposal. And then as we work our way through it, we come up with articulation of this common vision. What are the services that are going to be done by a centralized group? What's going to remain in the agency? Stefan's been working on that quite a bit. And then forming that security team and forming that. He's already got a nucleus of them from his own group in ESO from the data center. This is the same process we used at the data center as well. Definition of the security services and then the implementation plan and working with each individual agency to go through and say, all right, well, you know, y'all got 2 people, one of them's doing, you know, they're both doing some security, but this one's doing more servers or this one's doing more firewalls or this one's doing more network, and this is how this thing is going to play out. And then one at a time going through with each agency and figuring out what makes sense that the agency investigations. Investigations is something that clearly belongs in the agency. It's not something that we'd centrally perform or provide or whatever because it just doesn't make any sense for us. So we're going to go ahead and leave that in the agency and we'll make that correction on the back side. On the front side of it, we have to work through that. We're going to, I don't want to say we're going to err on the side our concern is we want to be sure that we can collect the right sets of resources and the right people so that we do capture the true security activities in the agency. As Stefan had said, the problems that we're running into, I had low expectations, and we're failing to meet even that. So we're really finding a lot of big problems out there that a lot of folks thought somebody else was taking care of, and they haven't been. So And that's really the thing. And then after that, we move to the approval process. After we come to an agreement with each agency, this is what we're doing, this is what stays, this is what goes. We go into a detailed execution plan. We do the transformation. We refine our catalog, because in some cases, we're going to pick services up. Somebody may be doing something, and we say, oh, that's really neat. You know what? We're going to take that into our catalog, and we'll go ahead and do it centrally. And then we go into operational state. So that's really the process, if you will, the high-level process of how we're going to transform the security. It's not going to happen all at once. It's not going to happen overnight. Figure it's going to take us, you know, going through 20-some agencies that have security staff, probably going to take us 6 months to a year to get through it all, you know, to get it all right. But this is kind of what we're looking at doing here. So that's our method. That's our process. That's our high-level flow chart. If you have any questions or things, and again, this is obviously a first cut at this. So this will get prettier over time as I work through the different pieces and say what it is that, you know, what are the components of this as the common vision gets done and we get our definition, as we get a securities catalog together, catalog of services, that one will blow out. And so I'll get better at this as I go forward. But really, we've done this in ESO, ETS. We'll do this in each agency as we transform them. So that's the end of our presentation.
So,
yes.
So you talked about the 20 agencies or thereabouts that you're going to get through this biennium, and that leaves how many agencies that you need to go through?
Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, thank you for the question. It's kind of an interesting exercise to try to count all the agencies, boards, and commissions, and I get varying numbers. The last number I heard was somewhere in between 85 and 90. Many of those are super small boards, and so actually the process that we're looking at the low end looks a lot different than what this kind of engagement. And the team is actually putting out right now, working on what an RFP would look like for basically getting one vendor to come and do like 20 or 30 of the smallest boards and commissions all at once. Because those will look more like a one day, I come in, I do some surveys, I look around, and then I move on to the next one. So that plan, we're working on the RFP, but probably the execution will fall into the next biennium.
Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, if I may add on to that, an interesting, and it's early yet, I get that, but a counterintuitive result that we've been finding is that with the smaller agencies, we're getting fewer critical errors per endpoint than we are with the larger agencies.
Yeah.
You would have thought it would have been the opposite, but it's not. We're actually and this is early yet. We got a lot, many, many more small agencies than we do large agencies. However, and we are targeting the larger agencies. But again, counterintuitively, what we're finding is that on the smaller agencies, we're finding fewer critical vulnerabilities per endpoint.
Yes, Representative.
So I don't think that's counterintuitive, because at the larger agencies, you have more IT people, and they cause vulnerabilities. But as a former IT person and a causer of vulnerabilities. But anyway, and I have some go ahead and comment on that. That's fine.
That's all right.
But anyway, I get that. So on some of the simple things, there's some of the kind of the low-hanging fruit. So the first one I can think of would be periodic changing of passwords. How are we doing on that statewide? Do you have any numbers or any guesses on that?
Representative Nierman, members of the committee, it's a great question. The problem is, as we see today, and they'll see in these risk assessments that will come out in the reports, every one of the agencies manages this discreetly, meaning they do it on their own. So when you say the password changing policy, it depends on which agency I'm talking to. The idea would be of bringing this together would be to try and get much more commonality in that, so that I could answer that question in a good way and say, nope, we change them every 60 days and everybody does it, right? And right now it's every agency makes that decision.
And they vary widely, sir. Some of them never change them. Some of them change them.
Sure, and I'm even okay if it has some permanent variability, because it might be appropriate that some change them mm-hmm. more, or it might be a fight that's not worth having over 6 months or 5 months or something like that. So I get that. That's fine. But so that makes me think of kind of a process question then. So how like, so on a question like that, so changing your passwords, or another one that I would consider to be kind of low-hanging fruit, yes, is the deactivation of people that are no longer with the state or no longer in a position where they need certain access like that.
Yes.
And so I assume your answer would be kind of similar, that different agencies are different and we don't really have the numbers on that. So, but you're going to end up driving that, and you're going to drive that through the local agency security officers that used to work for the agencies but now report to the CIO's office or to you, I guess, Steph, Mr. Richards, right? So,
Representative Nierman, one of the difficult things that is going to come about as we do this is it's exactly like you said, that I would be working with individuals, but some of the things that you describe in order to fix them imply IT changes, which means in a centralized security, decentralized IT, it's going to be a very interesting. Yeah. I can't even tell you how it will unfold.
Yeah.
I only know you'll have a clear champion and a unified group pushing forward on that agenda.
Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, Representative Nierman, what you're talking about is provisioning, essentially provisioning, and what we would and so in part that's going to have to be a cooperative effort with the HR groups for each of those agencies as well. When people start, how people are let go, and what have you, and we'll and the help desks for those agencies as well that run that provisioning. Our interest is going to be to make sure that as termination reports are done, that those are being checked by the security group to make sure that they have been deprovisioned, that those people are done. But it will be a lagging thing, not a proactive. That's really going to remain bespoke to each or unique to each agency, however their HR process works and however they do provisioning. So it's a bit more than I can bite off.
But can I follow up? So then, but then I don't know who to point at. Probably Mr. Richards here. So you'll end up checking that, though. You'll end up being the auditor of that, or the certifier of that process, or whatever. Even if the process is slightly different in each agency, right?
So Representative Nierman, members of the committee, I think maybe inspector is the right term, not quite auditor.
Okay. Yeah.
So just like any other security team would do in a normal IT organization, we would be filling that role. So we would be laying out sort of here are the expectations and then coming and see if those expectations are happening. One of the things we're trying to do at the more central level, though, is to make sure that we have a risk management program that looks at the enterprise rather than each agency, and that those decisions that are being made at each agency are not affecting the enterprise, and where they are, just an enterprise, local agency decision, that we have a process for, like, oh, we're going to have an exception here. Is that exception forever, or is that just for a while? And if it's just for a while, that we actually have a process to follow up. Okay. Today, we don't have any of that. Decisions get made, and they don't even, a lot of times, they don't even get written down, and that just becomes the way we work.
And representing part of that is up to us.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, sir, it is.
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity, and if there are, as we go forward, we look forward to meeting with you all again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your presentation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Great. What do we have next?
Sure. Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, before we transition to the next item, I wanted to give you somewhat of an update in terms of the Legislative Fiscal Office. We, of course, take this on your behalf, take this issue very seriously. The Legislative Fiscal Officer has invested in some training for both myself and my counterpart, Bob Cummings, in our office. Bob has gone through the Certified Information Systems Security Professional Training. He's passed that examination. I've gone through the Certified Information Security Manager training, have passed that examination. We're also pursuing federal information clearances at the secret level. I have mine. Bob is pursuing his from time to time as issues are escalated and the federal government wants to brief state government. Security clearances are required, and so mm-hmm. we're obtaining those on your behalf, and again working very closely with the state CIO's office. Lastly, we have recently got involved with the NCSL Task Force on Cybersecurity. I've been appointed the Oregon member on that group, and from time to time I'll make sure to share appropriate information with the committee.
So the two trainings that you mentioned that you and Bob have taken, do we own those trainings, or that is it?
Actually, they're done through industry organizations, certifying organizations. The training I went through, the Certified Information Security Manager training, is through ISACA, which is the Information Systems Audit and Control Association. Mm-hmm. And then the CISSP examination, that training is handled through, I believe, IS Cubed. It's an organization that now is the certifying body for that training.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet. So the next item up, Chair Riley, members of the committee, is the Oregon Department of Transportation. They'll be giving an information technology overview of not only their general IT operations, but also a specific set of projects. So if you could come on up, and please remember to introduce yourself for the record.
Welcome.
All right. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Riley and members of the committee. For the record, Bob Gebhardt, Chief Administrative Officer of the Department of Transportation. And with me today is Curtis Dankar, Chief Information Officer. And we're here to give you an overview of the agency's technology profile, IT profile, how technology is enabling ODOT's business, high-level IT projects and programs. And then after Curtis is done with most of that, we'll have Tom Lauer come up. Tom is our chief engineer, and he'll tell you a little bit about how automation is assisting us with ODOT's business and give you an update on the state radio project. With that, I'll turn it over to Curtis.
Okay, thank you. For the record, my name is Curtis Danka, Chief Information Officer with the Oregon Department of Transportation. It's an honor here to be here before you to go through. I will give an overview of some bullet points of agency budget size, org structure. And then one of the things I really want to talk about is within ODOT, the technology and the enablement of the business. I've got some slides in here that really talk about what the staff do and how they engage the business to really the technology infrastructure, the highway infrastructure and, you know, the DMVs and motor carrier technology is just ingrained in all of those. So I'd like to go through those and talk about where the technology is and how that's deployed and some of the work that we're doing. First, I'd like to start with the agency mission, which is very important to us. We work with staff all the time to really kind of refine the information systems branch mission vision. Staff always go back to the agency mission, which is to provide a safe, efficient transportation system that supports economic opportunity and livable communities for Oregonians. And the ISB mission is we are partners and stewards to provide and secure innovative and flexible technology solutions, services, and tools for current and future transportation successes. And with that, the vision is the trusted technology partner and advisor providing safe transportation across Oregon. One thing I'd like to call out is that I've been within the Oregon Department of Transportation as their CIO for about 3 years, and there's just a ton to learn. There's so much to learn in this organization. I've been in state service for 15 years, and I just learn more every day. The other thing is it's a really interesting, cool place to work. Most of the folks that are here are really energized, and they really see the value that they bring to the organization, especially in information technology, because this is an agency that we live every day. We travel every day. We see the technologies. We see the signs. We see the weather conditions. And so it is neat talking through all of those things and really discussing where information technology can enable the business. So here's the organizational structure. Of course, to my left is Chief Administrative Officer Bob Gebhardt, Chief Information Officer. Off to the right, the dotted box, you heard from Mr. Jared Chalk a couple of weeks ago. He's our Strategic Technology Officer. He brought to you the Information Resource Plan. And we are separated, ISB is separated into our distinct groups, which is really in alignment with the business. There's Transportation Application Development, TAD, DMV Application Development, Motor Carrier Application Development, and then we have Enterprise Technology. And the next slide is going to speak to kind of how that's how that looks. Governance. I would, call out that, this was a goal of the IRM plan when Jared talked about it, that it would bring a cohesive government. I believe it was IRM Goal 5. And this is essentially our governance structure. I'll kind of start at the bottom. You've got the infrastructure community of interest. That is the tie of all the systems. That's the server. That's the network infrastructure. We interface with Enterprise Technology Services in the data center, with Stefan and Alex's office, the office of the state CIO. We have the DMV systems, motor carrier systems, central services systems, the kind of business back-end system glue there, the transportation systems. And then for each of those, we have what we call a community of interest. And that essentially is a governing board over the projects that we work on in each of those areas. Over that, you've got the IS management team and then the enterprise IT planning executive staff. And that's where things go for across the agency governance, ultimately with the director of the agency making the final decisions, should it come to that. So just some facts, highlights about positions, ratios, things like that. We have 213 permanent positions. That services about 4,500 ODOT employees. Information systems, if you do that math, that comes out to about 4.95% of all of the folks at ODOT are in information technology. This staff to management ratio within ISB is about 20 to 1. 61% work in application development and maintenance. The others would be infrastructure, servers, security, those types of functions. And then this is a one that I wanted to throw out, about 46% of ISB staff are eligible to retire within the next 5 years. The budget look over the last three biennia, consistently ODOT has made up somewhere between 2.5-2.6% of the total budget. Broken it out here by major area, you've got about $10 million or 10% in services and supplies. Personal services makes up about $42 million, which is about 53%. And then that other orange slice there, state government service charges, that's about $39 million. That would be the way ODOT has got the budget structured is data center charges, OSCIO, ESO, they all do funnel through the ISB budget and how that works out. We like to talk about a strategic approach. In working with Jared and talking about the IRM plan and the goals, I've called out a few here which line up with those IRM goals that you heard about earlier. Modernize the system. That was IRM goal number two across the technology, the transportation economic development category. You'll see this later when we talk about some of our projects. It's something that we strive to do. ODOT's been around a while. I've got a very, I would say, entertaining slide here later that talks about one of our older systems that we're working to modernize. It's a screenshot from that system. We have, of course, legislatively mandated projects, support project management quality in the stage gates. We have several projects that are in the stage gate process right now. Obviously, the big ones are, and we're working with Jared, with ESO and the Office of the State CIO in the stage gate process there. Online, web, cloud, mobile technology, this is where it's headed. We're working through with DAS and other agencies on mobility and utilization of the cloud, but that we do that in a responsible way, that our data is ours, it's protected, we can get to it, we can get it back, those types of things. And of course, security and supporting security unification. We just heard from Alex and Stefan about Senate Bill 90, about the executive order. We have really, really close alignment and engagement and support those efforts. I have one of my key managers is heavily involved in the efforts around security unification for a couple of reasons. Obviously, this affects the agencies, and we secure our assets, and I want to have an agency perspective there, but I think that there's some real value that can be gained by having agency involved in what that security unification looks like. And, of course, this was IRM goal number one in the Transportation Economic Development IRM plan. This is about technology enabling ODOT's business. I mentioned earlier, we see technology every day when we utilize the road infrastructure. And I think even I, before I came to this agency, didn't realize the amount of information technology that was a part of the transportation system. I know when I go on trips with my family and my wife, you know, they get kind of tired of me calling out, oh, that roadside cabinet has this stuff in it, and oh, look, there's the readers for the motor carrier thing, and there's the rider, and we just got weighed as we traveled over the scale and things like that, because you really start to see it when you know that it's there. You know, we've got side fire radar out there to help with traffic congestion, and so we're calling these things out, and it's, you know, it's there's a lot of it out there. And so the goal would be, of course, that the transportation system flows and that people don't see it, but when you kind of look around and see it, it's pretty neat to see it all out there. So I mentioned that screen. So supporting legacy systems. This is an actual screen from the mainframe, from the DMV system. Enabling technology enables the business. Technology has been enabling the business for a very long time. And there are definitely opportunities to have technology enable the business in better ways. This is an actual data entry screen from DMV that is currently in use today. And doesn't look really friendly. Maybe for the person that's been using it for quite a while, it might be. But you got to know the screen well and what's there. And so just talking a little bit about DMV and how technology enables ODOT's business. About 60% of DMV employees work on maintenance and daily break fix in DMV operations. About 40% of DMV employees work on new systems, project development, and legislative mandates. DMV issues about 1,000 suspensions for Oregon driver's license per day under 900 different codes for suspensions. Processed over 15 million electronic records for vehicle registrations that were previously processed on microfilm. We have some efforts to try to get off the technology, the old technology of microfilm. Image documents get less paper-centric. And DMV will begin processing driver's license on digital systems in March 2017, no longer using microfilm. That's a huge deal for a DMV, a system that's been around as long as it has.
This month?
Yes. That's right.
Is it going to be like a ribbon cutting?
Well, they've actually been doing imaging for quite a while. And it's not to say that the Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, they've been doing a lot of imaging, and this is just the dependency on that microfilm.
Okay, there. So it's more like a shutoff date, or
they're still going to Co-Chair Nathanson. They're still going to have the equipment. So they still have those records. They just they're done imaging those records.
Right. For
yeah.
Like a day forward.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes. So this was a fun day. I was actually here. I do believe that there were other members, I think some of this committee and others that had seen this process. You notice the balloons. There are some things sort of you remember in life. This, for me, was one of them because I was there to see the very first credit card swiped through a card reader. And 2 years ago, Mr. Clyde Psyche and I were here. Not a single DMV office had had a card reader implemented at that point. And today, we're proud to say that we have all the DMV offices, all 60 have the credit card readers in the office. May not seem like that big a deal. We use credit cards every day. But just from a convenience factor, there's that technology integration component. We have to integrate these card readers in a compliant way with legacy systems. And so it was a fun day. It was fun seeing the customers come in there and wonder why the balloons were going in the air and all this stuff. You know, all I did was swipe my credit card. What the heck is, you know, what's going on? But it was a big deal for the staff. And we've heard nothing but a lot of positive comments, especially from DMV staff about how, again, this new technology is helping them process payments faster. We're not quite done. We're getting there. The chip readers are the next technology. We have two pilot offices right now. And by the end of this weekend, I asked yesterday, they're going to turn on the code, essentially, to enable the chip readers in all of the offices. And they've been piling those chip readers for some time now. A little statistics, if I may, on that. All 60 DMV offices have been conducting debit and credit card transactions since September of 2016. They account for about $27 million in transactions since September 1st.
DMV and about now, what proportion of transactions is that? Either transactions or money.
Sure.
So two different numbers.
Co-chair Nathan, co-chairs, members of the committee. It's about 40%. At the 60 DMV offices, about 40% of the transactions are paid by debit credit cards. Mm-hmm. And at the larger metro offices, it's about 65%. Hmm. And that accounts for 37% of all of the funds collected at this point. I did ask DMV some questions about this. They did expect the numbers to be higher. People are still used to interacting with the DMV to bring cash or to bring check. And so as word gets out, we fully expect those numbers to increase. So later, we will be coming back, Tom McClellan, and his team will be talking more about the service transformation program. So I'm just going to touch it on a little bit. When we're really thinking about, again, technology enabling the business of ODOT, there's just a couple of bullets. I won't go through them all, but there's some goals that have been laid out from, you know, waiting in line to more services online. We've heard things like online instead of in line, those types of things. Technology that constrains business partners to interface. And those kind of things. And we're really looking at engaging in projects that enable, that the technology enablement is there. A couple that I'll talk about that are major projects that we're tracking. We have the driver's license issuance replacement project. The driver's license issuance replacement project plan currently has the new license style being issued by mid-year 2018. The contract with the previous fulfillment vendor has reached its time limit, which was over 10 years, and a contract with the new vendor was signed as a result of the extensive request for proposal process. I mentioned the microfilm replacement project. In January 2016, the microfilm replacement project to replace the old microfiche technology with modern digital imaging was put into production. Since that start date, over 15 million documents have been imaged. And not only does this save microfiche and paper storage space, it allows DMV staff to more immediately access the customer documents. TripCheck. Obviously, this is a tool that a lot of people use. We found this out firsthand on December 14th when we had the big Snowmageddon day. We had over 80,000 peak hits per minute on the TripCheck servers. We found out the capacity of the TripCheck servers. They never went down, but we definitely knew. We saw the rails basically hit the top of the graph. And we had since worked with the data center to increase the capacity of these servers. The infrastructure is such that there's three servers in a cluster, what's called a clustered environment, which means they handle the load. They're load balanced. We could bring one server down during a non-peak time, upgrade it, increase the number of processors, bring it up. So when we did the upgrade, there was no actual downtime of the TripCheck system. So we essentially doubled or tripled its capacity overnight and able to do that. And we much better weathered the, no pun intended, excuse me, the next series of storms that came through. And we didn't have the peaking out of the servers. Just a couple of things to note out. This is a technology that we are always that's always evolving as well. I kind of threw some things up there. There's a camera that feeds into the transportation operation centers and the TripCheck system. We have Waze integration now. So those of you that use Waze, that is something that is end users can look on their phone and report in events. And that's a two-way feed to the TripCheck system. If people are starting to report slow traffic, Waze will send the data to ODOT, and ODOT will also send the data to Waze if there are significant events on the freeway systems as well. So, again, that's an ever-evolving technology. So intelligent transportation system. You see this the most when you take a trip up to Portland, especially on Highway 217, up I-5, 205, 84. There is a ton of technology on the infrastructure up there. Of course, we have the intelligent route metering, that's sensitive to both traffic flow, weather events. It adjusts the cycle of the route metering. You've got the advisory speeds, and in Eastern Oregon now, there's actually a white regulatory sign as well on I-84 near Baker. The travel time signs, traveler information signs, also called the variable message speed signs, which notify the travelers. And then you've got weather-related and curve warning signs. And these are interesting. Again, it's that technology that once you know it's there, you kind of start looking for it. There's actually a laser that scans the road in a few places along 217 and 26. It calculates the coefficient of friction and displays the correct speed, the advisory speed, but whether or not that slippery when wet sign comes on. Older technologies just measured temperature on the road, but if the road's slick or warm or oily, it's also able to compensate for that condition on the road. We have motor carrier, and again, a lot of technology on the road there. The first picture that you're seeing there, you'll see these booms overhanging the freeway when you come down from I-5 north and south. This is the readers. So there's a transponder in the cab. It sends up information, and in about a second, this truck will pass under the rider, and then the trucker gets notified whether or not to pull into the way station or to go ahead and bypass. And that's a technology also that's being used more and more. 35,000 trucks out there have the transponders. There's been 339,000 green light crossings since the first. I didn't write down what month that was. Excuse me for that. Which translates to about 5,000 per day. That's probably the better number there. 95% green light success. So a lot of stuff is checked when they pass through the system, and they have about a 95%. That would mean that the carrier has everything in order when they pass through that. At the lower right, we're doing more with LPR, license plate readers. That helps the flow of the trucks. They have to key in the license plate. It would go pull the carrier information, then display it back. Maybe something they had to check. They don't have to key that, at least at the Woodburn port of entry there, and we're looking to expand that in other places as well. The other part that, and Sean, I might ask, you have my device there.
I'm Curtis's straight man here.
Again, 2 years ago, we were just starting the implementation of Senate Bill 810, and that was to pilot the road usage charge program. And I'm happy to say that July 1st, this will be actually the two-year anniversary of the implementation of Senate Bill 810. Over 1,330 vehicles have participated in the program. That's over 11.4 million taxable miles as a part of the program. And again, the technology tie here is while, I won't go into details about Senate Bill 810. I know that some of you are engaged in that, but that's my device there. I have a relationship with that vendor, which is Azuga. That relationship is between me and that third-party vendor. I can go up and see statistics and what my tax is. Quarterly, they make a payment. It's more of a cumulative payment to the ODOT fuels tax system through a system called Ruckus, and that is how ODOT would. Again, it's a pilot. There's lots more to come with road usage charge program. The next project is the FAST Act federal grant, and this is kind of the next step. This is another project that's being tracked at a major projects level.
Thank you. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this device, my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, there are two different types of devices that can be in use. One is simply tracks the mileage. The other also tracks where you are, where your mileage occurs. Is that correct?
Co-chairs, Senator Riley, yes, that is true. The Azuga device that you have right there, that's a GPS and cellular-enabled device. There's another device. Part of the goals of the program was to have options, and that's also what's being explored in sort of the next phases of this, what would a mandatory program look like. And there is a device that only tracks mileage. And then I know that, again, that's the kind of the policy side. They're looking at even more options for how this might be deployed in a mandatory program in the future.
So with this, do you have a follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
So with this device, we quit taxing you when you leave the state. Is that?
Co-Chair, Senator Riley, yes. In fact, last weekend I had to go down to California. It stopped recording once I hit the border. Mm-hmm. I did what I needed to do there, came back, and that's when it would pick up that mileage calculation again. And, of course, the way the system works is it credits your fuel. So if I buy fuel at the pump, it knows how many gallons my vehicle used through that device and then credits back, so you're not paying twice.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where's this program go? It's reaching its end of its 2 years.
Co-chairs, Senator DeBoer, right now, it is, as I understand it, and again, this is, I don't know, there's a policy side of this that's occurring as well about where the program goes next as far as if it does become a mandatory program. There is no end date, to my knowledge right now, on the implementation of Senate Bill 810. We have no directive to stop it on a particular date. The pilot is going to continue. People can go out to the Origo site, register, get their devices, and the program continues on.
Okay.
Okay, I'd like to talk quickly about the business support functions. This is central services. We also, you know, there is technology and just the support of ODOT. And so we have a lot of field services units, technicians out there, security teams. ODOT's financial system is called TEAMS. ISB folks maintain that system as well. We're working on a new time and attendance system, which is a shared service with DEQ and ODA, Department of Agriculture. I believe Jared spoke to that as a part of the IRM plan as well, looking for opportunities for shared services. The HR systems, we have SharePoint collaboration systems, we have our intranet, we have geospatial programs, we have facilities applications, fleet tracking, and then fuels tax systems as well. And we do quite a bit of work just on, I like to parallel the ODOT infrastructure, the highway infrastructure, to the technology infrastructure as well, that there is a lot of work that's done there just to keep the existing infrastructure. It's much like a bridge earthquake retrofit is a lot of work needs to be done. At the end, you've got a stronger bridge, but it's ready to, the infrastructure is there to support the future. We have our major projects list. This is the list that we work most closely with the Office of the State CIO and with the Legislative Fiscal Office. I mentioned a number of these projects through the presentation. Here's a summary list. Of course, we have DMV and microfilm replacement. Off to the far right, I wanted to note where we are with the stage gate process. Several of these initiatives started before the stage gate process was implemented. So you'll see some pre-stage gate or not applicable components to that. DMV credit card, I talked about that initiative. I have an NA there. It didn't need to go through the stage gate process. However, there's a lot of visibility there, so we did have some oversight on that project. We have driver's license issuance replacement, DLIR. I talked about that one earlier. Service transformation, that's the biggie. That's what will be, Sean, I'm assuming, brought back here to talk more specifics about the service transformation program and the DMV systems. And then we have enterprise time and attendance, just a note there that's the shared service, and then the Origo FAST Act agency partnering with new technologies. And moving forward, if I may, call ODOT's chief engineer up to discuss with me some of the other technologies that are occurring within the agency to talk about technology integration and a lot of the work that ODOT is moving forward with there.
Good. And we're hoping to conclude the ODOT part of this meeting at what time?
So I think
2:25?
Yeah, we'll need to conclude about 2:25 to leave 20 minutes or so for the last topic.
Thank you. Co-chairs, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Thomas Lauer. I'm the chief engineer for ODOT. The slide in front of you shows, we call it PEGI. It's the Pegasus Mobile Mapping Surveying Equipment. It's worth about $750,000. That upper unit is where all the expenses. That is a LIDAR system that shoots out 1,200,000 laser points per second. And you can go down the road at 55, 60 miles an hour and survey our highways. And what you see in the picture adjoining it is not a normal picture. Every pixel in that is a survey point. It's correct, geographically correct into the state system. And there, every dot in that map is, in that picture, is accurate within an eighth to a quarter of an inch. And we can do that at, as I say, 55, 60 miles an hour. We have over 98% of our system currently surveyed. And OSU has looked at this device and done a cost-benefit analysis, and we're seeing over 285% return on investment from utilizing this equipment. What it particularly does, in the next slide, is it starts to help us with the second phase of it, and that is we're doing all our designs in 3D. Well, not all of it. We're doing the girth work. We're going to move on to bridge and traffic systems later. But on this equipment that you see up there, they're all equipped with GPS gathering data. So they can gather, they have antennas that collect GPS data. There's a computer in those machines that we literally load the design into. And that machine then can build that road or that section of grade without any staking at all, because the design is loaded in. It's far more accurate than one can do. It has significant cost savings for the contractor, less rework, and is a much faster process. For example, Woodburn Interchange used this technology, finished a year earlier. So that's a tremendous leap forward as we're able to do significant GPS data collection, then use it in our designs, and then load it literally into the contractor's machines and execute the design straight from the machine without the operator having to look at plans or stakes or anything of that nature.
Thank you. There's a question from the senator.
It's not really a question so much as a comment. I recognize the top photo being the Bly Mountain cutoff on Highway 140 over going over Bly Mountain, and I drove that daily for a year and a half, and the technology was quite incredible as they did that. How many miles of
I don't know.
Yeah, it really is impressive to realize that the survey trucks aren't out there, that the guy driving the equipment is getting all his data on time in real time.
Co-chairs, member committees, thank you for that point. The technology is even greater than that. If there was a problem or a bust in the grade, that could be conveyed back to the designer through the network, who can then upgrade the design and load it right back to the contractor and seamlessly right into the machine and continue to move forward. So it just becomes a seamless partnership between how we survey, how we design, and how we then partner with our contractor. So it becomes one unified system that we hope to have it. Now, this is what we, back a slide, we call that 3D design and construction. And OSU has looked at it as well, and we're seeing in the order of 2,000% return in investment from that sort of system. And it's incredible amount of time and cost savings that we see from it. So it's really the wave of our future. Next slide. Now, two years ago, we were given instructions to change the speed limits within Eastern Oregon. And you gave us between July, when the bill was signed and executed, through to March of the following year, about 9-10 months, to implement it. And that's fine for traffic signal signs, speed signs. But for the no passing striping on the roads at your curves, at different places that you would put no passing lanes in, we literally had to get that accomplished between July and September. And that falls onto our striping crews. And the traditional way that the striping crews, not just in the state but across the nation, and many still do it, is what you see those two gentlemen doing. They sit there at a pole of a certain height that's roughly your eye height in a vehicle, and they look to see each other. And that's a trivial distance because they're doing that for photo op. they're really about 1,100 feet apart. And you can see they're standing there with their backs to traffic. It's not safe. It's time-consuming and high difficulty. Well, a lot of our bright young engineers got a hold of it. And the traffic group that had responsibility talked to the surveyors who have our system in the can because they had used our mobile mapper. They handed it to our roadway crews who put it in our CAD software or in-road software and told them, here's the parameters that you need to search and define on the system. And all those little X's, those red X's and little green triangles are passing, no passing lanes. So the software went through with a breeze and defined it for every 10 feet along the road. Then they threw Google Earth underneath so they could see the kind of features that was being affected. We give a list to the painters, and instead of having to stop and do that awkward bit of work and then bring in a contractor to keep up on their normal striping, they simply had to go paint it as they went. And we saved about $250,000 in our central region alone by using this technology. And we met the timelines that were required. Slide. So now I'll move on to the other part of my presentation, which is a closeout, essentially, a closeout report on the state radio project. Slide.
You said a closeout report.
Well, I hope it is. I think we're there.
And that's when we first met because
yes, we
of
did.
This project.
you can see some of the earlier conditions, and actually there are some of our, well, I wouldn't say better facilities, but not so bad facilities. We had some that were even more dismal than those on the left-hand side, and you can see what we've been able to do on the east side. We've upgraded 154 sites, 45 new towers, 29 new shelters, 40 new power generators, upgraded the VHS system. We've installed 143 digital microwave connections at 137 sites. We've installed narrowband repeaters at 168 sites and new antennas on 139. So we've done a significant amount of physical infrastructure improvements. Slide. We've installed in vehicles and or mobile phones to officers at OSP more than 5,500 radios as a part of the system. We've installed 118 radios at ODOT or OSP sites. 41 of the sites are using the new trunking system, which allows high volume radio traffic. 67 dispatch consoles for both ODOT and for OSP have been installed. 12 new, and in the bottom corner you see the new strategic reserve trailers, which are used for emergency events, fires. There are 12 of them scattered across the state in multiple locations so that they're available come an emergency. All that work was done in a live system. So every day, every piece of new equipment that was installed had to work and work reliably the day we installed it. Let me get my numbers. We completed partnerships with 13 agencies covering 42 sites. That where we share equipment, facilities, and resources so that we have a cost savings between all of us. There's a substantial improvement in the reliability of the system. Security increases both the on a technical aspect within the radios and also physically with the sites, alarms on doors and things of that nature, so if there's any issues or breaches that we are aware of it. If there's any of the backup systems fail, we're automatically alerted to it. So we have a very robust system in that area.
Could you please amplify just very briefly on the partnerships? 13 agencies, those are not all state agencies.
Co-chairs, member of the committee. Yes, they're not all the state. In fact, they are not. They are cities and local counties, and we have a multitude of them. And we have some of them that are not even partnerships were a part of building the system. They are post-partnerships. For example, City of Salem does the dispatching for Lincoln County for their police and fire. We entered an agreement where they're using our microwave to connect Salem with Lincoln County and do all that dispatching remotely. So there's a cost savings to those communities by being able to work together. And meanwhile, they're utilizing our system to connect them. So it's a win-win for everybody involved.
So this is an example of partnerships with local government around the state. And I just wanted to highlight that for members of the committee who weren't part of designing that program. But I think that's another benefit that should be underscored.
Co-chair and members of the committee, not only is it at that level, but we're now at a place of even these modern systems, this particularly the trunk system, has a lot of robust capacity beyond just your system. And we are literally starting to interconnect them. And we are interconnected with Lane County, and we're working and exploring it with others where our systems, even if they're from different manufacturers, are interconnected so that radio traffic can be moved through our systems to each other. In addition, the radios ODOT put in are of a high multi-spectrum levels. And you know, they're all computers these days. There's no longer crystals in these radios. And our systems that we put in can go across the full radio spectrum so that at any point our radios can connect into and log into, if necessary, local governments so that we can work. We also have the standard interoperability channels that we all come together and work come an event. You went too slide too quick on me. In the upper right-hand corner, in part of that picture, you see the large battery packs and the propane generators on the right-hand side of that picture that allow 2 or 3 week power supplies to these mountaintops if the commercial power is killed. So there's a very robust system. The towers are strong enough to stand a Cascadia-level event. Now, that doesn't mean those microwaves will all be pointed 30 miles to a pinpoint any longer, but the tower itself can stand the shake. We will have to repoint the mirrors because the literal ground will move that the tower is mounted on. But the tower is rigid and strong enough to support that. The central core switch, which enables the system to function in a trunk manner, is actually split, part of it being in here in Salem and the other part being in Benton. And if any and if one of them goes down, the other can take over full operation of the system. So we've been building in redundancy and robustness into the structure of the system. We have also increased the level of coverage across the state with the new radio system. We work very closely with OSP and the ODOT maintenance forces to find out where we had trouble spots, where we could add coverage, where we could make sure it was fully covered to meet their needs. And finally, that's the we conduct routine operations and enhanced our ability to do emergency interoperability. That is the City of Portland's Emergency Command Center participating in an event with us and with our federal partners as well to make sure that we're all communicating and ready to go come an emergency within the state. Slide. Well, the monies that matter. We have a budget. We were had given a budget of $229 million plus to build this project. We spent $220 to date. We have $9 million left to spend. That is as of end of January in our books. We expect a reserve of about $500,000 as we complete the project, and we will be complete on June 30th of 2017. A little caveat, it depends on all this lovely snow melts on some of our mountaintops. That's the ability to get access up to them. And you can see the spending curve slide. And finally, we will complete on time and on budget. We have closed out 198 contracts out of 217 who are part of this project. The assets have been transferred appropriately from the project group to the radio operation group. The last switchovers of the trunking system for both ODOT and OSP were delayed until they come out of the snow season. In other words, we're going to institute the trunking system once they're done with the potential for snow events so that they don't have a brand new system operating at the same time they may be trying to respond to snow events. And as I said, we're also working to, and I think it'll be an ongoing effort to connect with the multiple large radio systems throughout the state. And that concludes my presentation. One time. Open to any questions.
Questions and comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, yes, Senator.
No question. I've got a 2:30 okay. that I've got to run to.
All right. Thank you. So I was just recalling the picture that you had of the mobile mapping thing.
Yes.
Thinking that system is, if anyone thought that was anything like watching the Google Street View camera go around your neighborhood, this is nothing like that.
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. I will tell you a couple other interesting facts. That has like 12 cameras on it. We can even do crack detection in the pavements. It can be wired to do ground penetrating radar. It can do air monitoring. It has a multiple, we haven't done all these mm-hmm. things. But I'll tell you one of the most interesting things. We're now using not just the US GPS satellites, we're also using the Russian satellites. We figured, hey, they've been targeting us for years. So you buy a software program, you put on their proper antenna, and now we have many more satellites to help improve our accuracy. So okay. If there's an opportunity, we take advantage of it.
We heard it here today. Thank you again.
Even into the Russians.
We're communicating with the Russians.
I think we're utilizing their satellite assets for the benefit of the United
and
States.
And that's being entrepreneurial.
Well, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, the last topic up is an overview of the Information Resource Management Plan for the Healthy People Program Area. If you could please come up and remember to introduce yourself for the record before you begin presenting. And we will need to end the meeting promptly at quarter till. There's another meeting that is going to start just after that.
Absolutely.
I think you should have enough time.
I will make sure that I do. Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ethan Benatan. I'm the Strategic Technology Officer for the Healthy People Policy Area. Assisting me here today is my colleague, Darren Wellington, Strategic Technology Officer for Public Safety. Thank you for this time to tell you a few highlights from the Information Resource Management Plan for the policy area. I have the full plan has been uploaded with the meeting materials. I am aware that this is your sixth such presentation, and I will make sure to present information that is relevant to the policy area. I'm going to be talking a little bit about what informs the plan itself, the agencies involved, some of the highlights from the document, including some information about IT governance, the use of enterprise services, information security, an overview of the project portfolio. So I think you've heard in general terms about what has informed the information resource management plans. I thought I'd call out a couple of items of particular interest in this policy area. Legislative direction in this policy area includes one example was Senate Bill 604 of 2013, where the agencies were instructed to develop a common credentialing program so that medical providers in the state of Oregon could easily have their credentials uniformly and validated once for the state. That is currently underway as part of the Oregon Health IT portfolio of projects. There's also drivers for this policy area include key agency imperatives. An example of that, the very top priority for the Department of Human Services is to reduce abuse and increase safety. So that is being supported by the Centralized Abuse Management Project, which is being done in DHS. It is an area rich in external mandates, federal mandates. For example, in privacy and security, we are required to comply with the federal, they're called MARS-E, Minimal Acceptable Risk Standards for Exchanges, which is requiring sweeping changes across many technologies in the policy area. Another example of a federal mandate that we have to meet is the requirement to remove Social Security numbers from Medicare cards, which requires a surprisingly large number of changes to the underlying technology systems, including one of our largest systems in the state, the Medicaid Management Information System, or MMIS. Last amongst the drivers, and one that affects probably every technology area, is the way that technology is changing. Mobile devices are, you've heard about, lots about them. They are being used extensively in the state, not only by staff at the agencies, by our partners, thousands of partners, but also by over a million Oregonians who are served by the agencies. And these are particularly important where physical services might be harder to come by in areas where Oregon is sparsely populated and less well served. Before I go any further, I just want to say thank you. There's not nearly enough names on that list. Many people contributed to this work. I want to call out most particularly the Chief Information Officer who serves both the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority, Kristen Deuce. She'll be in front of you in a few weeks. There are many more than three agencies in this policy area. Those were just the logos that I could find and that would fit. We'll talk about the agencies in the policy area in a moment. The principles that guided this work, I'll call out just a few of them. First of all, you've heard that this is the first time that we've done these kinds of plans across a policy area, so it's important to make this a foundation. So we've made an effort to capture the state of information technology adequately and accurately and to really be transparent about the forces that are involved. Where I'm coming from outside of the agency, but getting to work with the agencies, and given my background as a former CIO in healthcare and in education, it's been a great delight to me to see the good work that's going on under the hood. And so one of the things that I'm particularly driven to do is to share some things with you which you might not always see, because there's a lot of good work going on that might otherwise be invisible. And of course, we hope that this is a foundation for future collaboration and the adoption of enterprise and shared services. So the agencies, there are 23 agencies in the policy area. The top two on this list, the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority, form about 99% of the policy area measured by budget or staff. The remaining 21, 17 of them are small licensing boards. You heard Stephen Richards talk about the number of tiny agencies. These agencies max out at about 50 staff, and they go down to about 2 staff total. That's not IT staff. That's total staff size. So the Health Authority and the Department of Human Services are served by a shared IT department called the Office of Information Services. They have a single chief information officer. They are the largest IT department in the state, and as I mentioned, serving over a million Oregonians. While the work of every one of those boards is important. Most of their IT is tactical. Most of them have no IT staff. A few have a handful. None of them would have what you would call an IT department amongst those other 21 agencies. So I won't talk about them much, but they will come up a couple of times during the presentation. So our office is tracking the number of changes on an almost daily basis, but currently 21 major projects in this policy area. I've put 13 top ones up on this slide at the risk of making it too small to read. They range in value from about $500,000 to our largest current one is $162 million project value. I did want to zoom in on the next slide and tell you about just a couple of them very briefly to give you a feel for the kind of work that's being done. We certainly can't talk about them exhaustively here, and many of them will be coming in front of you to testify at the project level or at the agency level over the next few weeks. But I'd like to talk about, for example, the Centralized Abuse Management Program, which I mentioned earlier. It's implementing a comprehensive multi-program cross-agency system to capture abuse allegations and investigations from intake and screening through investigation and closure, including referrals and documentation. So this will support abuse management and investigations and oversight and inquiries into abuse in the state. So this project is essential to the top initiative of DHS to increase safety and reduce the abuse of children and adults. One other I'll call out very briefly, given our short time, is the Oregon Health Information Technology portfolio of projects. It actually consists of three sub-projects. I already mentioned common credentialing. Also included that is uniform provider directory, so that that will improve the ability of coordinating of care, of referrals, and of analytics across the state, because there's one place to go to look to find who a medical provider is. That doesn't exist right now. And also the clinical quality metrics registry, which will collect data to help determine, among other things, the performance of the coordinated care organizations. You've heard each one of my colleagues mention the adoption of enterprise systems that is very robust in this policy area. DHS and OHA have all of their servers and networks run by the state data center. They are not yet on state email systems, but that is expected to happen in the future. The small boards are all over the map, and so what we're doing in our office is working with them. I am working with them opportunistically. So as a server ages out or a contract expires, I will typically work with the small boards to try to get them on board enterprise services one at a time. You also have heard each of my colleagues talk about enterprise governance. And in the small agencies, as you know, since the executives are usually making the IT decisions, alignment is easy. In the very large agencies, two of the largest agencies in the state, Human Services and the Health Authority, a more formal structure is needed. So the nice part to say here is that there is one of the more sophisticated and formal governance models in the state is in play. It's under construction right now, but it's also being actively used. At the lowest level, the agencies prioritize reliable operations above anything else. And then there's three tiers of governance built on that, where for the smallest little investments that may be under 40 hours of time, the people closest to that system, the people who use it in the agency and the IT team that works on it would collaborate to do that prioritization. The next level up are information systems management committees. They have a broader purview, and they prioritize investments up to about 800 hours of time across multiple programs. They're typically staffed at an executive level. At the very highest level, prioritizing projects that cut across the agencies and that are very large projects, that is currently being done in a more ad hoc fashion, and a more formal structure is being built there. I think it's worth calling out the key opportunity in maturing governance, which is at this very highest level, it will help us to continually improve the sustainability of IT by shifting our investments from kind of rear guard action where we're fixing legacy systems to more investment in innovative work. And so I liken that to insulating your house or doing a seismic retrofit. It can be very expensive work. It can also be very invisible work. But it needs to be balanced against sometimes what are more pressing needs. And it's the highest level governance that's helping us with that. So you've heard each of my colleagues mention IT security. There's nothing outstanding in this area to mention, except for the fact that, of course, only DHS and OHA have any staff who in the IT security realm. The Information Security and Privacy Office that serves those agencies also has responsibility for e-discovery, for privacy compliance, and for information exchange. That ladder of information exchange being particularly critical in this policy area, where we are able to deliver better services and get better information about our clients when we do good information exchange, but it has to be done with great sensitivity for privacy and security. There were no detected technical breaches in this policy area during the time period. There were some human errors. One of those rose to the level of being reported to the Enterprise Security Office, so you will see a count of one breach from this policy area during the time. I haven't spoken much about the smaller agencies, but this is one place where, of course, as we heard earlier today, there is special attention being paid. Looking forward, one of the really exciting things about this policy area is that they have a formal and clear strategic plan for information technology that was developed in close collaboration with the business. They've highlighted five particular kinds of strategic involvement to guide future investments. I'd like to mention three of them really briefly for you off of this slide. The first one, promoting a comprehensive view of clients. In the current state of affairs, many of the clients who are served by one of these programs in the policy area are served by many. And oftentimes, those people have their information stored in systems that don't always talk to each other and that may be separate by the program. So the objective, the strategic objective, is to get a complete 360-degree view, actually even over time, of a client so that we can get a better understanding of how people are being served. And so that is guiding our ongoing investments. I'll show you a graphical picture of that in a moment. And you'll hear me say our investments sometimes, even though I don't work with the agencies, because they are my client agencies, and I'm a big fan of their work. So if I say us, I mean me and the agencies, even though I work for the state CIO. The second bullet, the providing trusted sources for health and human services data, is really the flip of the first from a systems view. So at an individual client level, we want to be able to understand the experience of a client. At the highest level, we want to be able to make system-level decisions and get program-level data to make better decisions. So it's the system's view of unifying that data. And when we invest in information systems in this area, we want to prioritize both of those. I'd like to jump to the last bullet on this slide and mention the somewhat cryptic text, using dynamic services to support dynamic needs. And really, I think what that cuts to is the idea of embracing modularity and reusability so that the IT environment can be simplified and can become more nimble, which will improve the ability to innovate over time.
So this is great timing. I see you have about four more slides in about 5 minutes.
Co-Chair Nathanson,
good time.
I will be on time. I cannot match the bells and whistles of the Department of Transportation, but I will be on time. That was a hard act to follow. So I told you I would tell you graphically about the strategic alignment. So the columns on this slide show those five strategies. I picked out just the same handful of projects that I zoomed in on earlier. And what you can see in the density of dots up there is that the agencies have been doing a very good job of making sure that where they choose to make investments, they're serving as many of their strategies as possible. Looking forward to the proposed projects that we're seeing, obviously, with the budget being what it is, the agencies have taken care to bring forward only the most important projects, so it's a short list right now. You will see there that two of them look pretty rich. One of them, the outlier there in the middle, has a single dot. That's a compliance-required project. It's the one I mentioned earlier for removing Social Security numbers, so there's special reasons for doing that project. So I may even finish ahead of time. In conclusion, it's our hope that this work will be supporting the agencies in the policy area in improving enterprise alignment with our office, the Office of the State CIO, also improving collaboration between the agencies, and identifying and pursuing opportunities for shared and enterprise services. So that does conclude my presentation. I would be very happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions? I'll just note that on the previous slide, I'm sort of amused at how hard it is to come up with names for projects. man, plan, the MMIS modularization planning. That's, you know, lots of syllables.
It is.
And WIC twist, WIC, you know.
And if I may, I would say that the modularization planning is right in line with the things I talked about how we build sustainability and reusability into systems. It's a planning project. It's in line with what the federal government is asking states to do. These are large systems. They are expensive systems, but they're cheap in comparison to the cost of the Medicaid systems that they support. And by building them to be nimble and by building them to fulfill requirements that we can't even imagine yet, I think they are really putting some wings to what we could do with information to support the future of Medicaid in the state. So thanks for calling that one out.
And thank you for that amplification on that project. Other comments, questions? Thank you for being here.
Great.
And for a good presentation. Thank you to everyone who stayed with us for the afternoon. We're adjourned.
He's just here for his device.
Sorry?
I say you're just here for your device. Just here for your device. Here for his device.
Sorry?
I say you're